Welcome to Software Gone Wild, a podcast focused on everything software-defined. In the last episode, we were talking with someone who built his own service provider gear, and today we'll have a guest that built their own white box switching solution. Actually, they build their own network operating system. Welcome, Russ White from Still LinkedIn.
Thanks. Still, I like the way you say that, Ivan. Still.
Well, you know, very soon we'll call you distinguished Microsoft engineer and you'll fix my Windows 7 machine.
Good luck with that.
So from CCDE to distinguished Microsoft engineer. Today, we have a huge number of co-hosts because everyone wanted to speak with Russ. So in, I guess, alphabetical order, Bob McCouch.
Good morning.
David G.
Or afternoon, as the case may be.
Could be evening for the person listening. Who knows?
That's true. How's everybody doing today?
Yeah, we're fine with that. And David, it's already afternoon where you are, right?
Yeah, it's nearly 5 p.m., so good afternoon.
And we have Eliza Jasinska from Poland, so she's even a bit further east than I am.
6 p.m. here. Good evening, I might say.
And we have a gentleman from the cornfield, Nick Braglio.
last and certainly the least.
No, it was really in alphabetical order, Nick, sorry.
No, it's good. It's all good. Doing well.
Back to Russ. The reason we are recording this particular podcast is because you guys at LinkedIn published a blog post a few months ago describing how you did your white box switching. When I started reading that, I was wondering, why would someone that's not the Google size, let's put it this way, do their own network operating system? What brought you to that decision?
There are a couple of reasons. First is that we want more analytics and more information about what's going on in our fabric. And our fabric, like you said, is not as big as Google's or someone like that. We are fairly large. We have 3 or 4 data centers, 1,700,000 bare metal servers or servers range size types of things. So we're fairly large. We're not as big as one of the big players, but we're not as small as perhaps your, I'm going to use the term, but I hate it, you know, mid-size enterprise or something like that.
The two-switch enterprise, yeah.
I don't like the term enterprise, and I don't like the term service provider. They're just networks, right? That's what they are. They're networks. I think we use those as excuses too often to say, I'm not going to use MPLS because I'm an enterprise or whatever the case might be. It's silly. Anyway, yeah, so we wanted more analytics. That's, I think, what started this drive. A second thing is we just want to be able to control our destiny better. We want to be able to say we're not reliant on a vendor's architecture. If you follow any particular vendor for long enough, I used to have a friend who worked at a big bank who I walked into in his office one day and said, what's going on with your network? He said, everything is wrong with my network. I said, okay, so why is everything wrong with your network? He said, because if you look at my network, I have some instance of every failed marketing and or architectural concept and push from my vendor someplace in my network still running today. We can't get rid of any of it. There's this sense that when you allow a vendor to push your architecture, you're actually allowing the vendor to push your business architecture as well, or push your business direction. Open protocols like BGP and OSPF are good, but there's a certain amount of, how shall I put it, you're a little bit high level sometimes for some of the things that you need to do. So this kind of started LinkedIn thinking down this path of doing our own NOS, which is still kind of up in the air, how we're going to do that and what we're doing, doing white box. I shouldn't say it's so much about saving money. I mean, money is always an issue, but it's not so much about saving money as it is actually just controlling our own future and understanding our network better and things like that.
So it looks like one of the things that you really were trying to accomplish was to get some better analytics, and I'm going to use the buzzword telemetry. As I was reading the blog, I noticed one of the things, you know, after my own heart, which was less reliance on SNMP, which is one of the things I hate more than anything else. It would be interesting to sort of go down the path of what you did to minimize that.
Okay, well, we haven't fully minimized it yet. We're working on it. The longer-term plan is, I don't know if you know much about Kafka, or Kafka, I don't know how you say it. It depends on where you're from, I guess. LinkedIn is a huge Kafka shop. In fact, LinkedIn open source developed an open source Kafka. And Kafka is basically a message bus type thing. And so our ultimate goal is to get our telemetry onto the message bus and get it out of SNMP. So we're looking at things like OpenComp and I2RS Yang models, topology models, things like this. We're looking in the Yang type of space as a modeling language, as well as some other places that we could look at doing raw stuff directly into the chipset and pulling that information into the message bus, into Kafka, so that we actually have our telemetry in the same plane or in the same operational sphere as our server operational information is today. So essentially, from an operational perspective, what we're trying to get to is you boot the white box switch and it just looks like a server to our server guys. There's no real, oh, it happens to have BGP configured on it or something else. Well, no different than it might happen to have a JVM configured on it or a Python engine or whatever else happens to be running on it. So there's not much difference from a server perspective is what we're trying to get to. And since we're a Kafka shop anyway, it makes sense for us to use Kafka in that role.
Can we back up a little here? Because Nick obviously prepared. I did not. I read the article.
Backing up. Sorry, go ahead.
Backing up. Exactly. I read the article on the blog when it came out a while ago, but I managed to forget everything about it. So how did all of this start and what exactly did you guys implement that you put on that white box?
Okay, well, how it all started was we started with basically, again, the concept of better telemetry, right?
This was the initial, like, this was the goal of the project?
The initial goal was better telemetry. The first idea was we are seeing problems in our fabric, or we have a lot of things we'd like to know about our fabric, about queue depths and things like this, that we can't see today through standard interfaces in a way that is easy for us to manage. Again, our data centers are primarily servers, right? So we're managing our servers a certain way. We can't manage our routers that way. So we need better telemetry to figure out how to manage those routers or the switches. People call them switches, but what's the difference between a layer 3 switch and a router, right? Marketing. Since we are layer 3 to the top of rack, you know, we have these layer 3 switches out there and we're seeing a lot of stuff going on in those switches and we don't really understand it because we don't have a good way to bring all that information together. So the initial drive was around that space, was around the concept of how do I get better telemetry into this stuff?
So then you have this idea, how do you go about it? How do you like write a white box operating system?
That is kind of where we are right now, is considering the options in building a white box operating system and what we use. Right now, we're using a couple of commercial products that are quasi-white box. Some of them are not open source. The ultimate goal is to position ourselves as more of an open source. And you have to realize some of this is kind of experimental. Not our entire fabric right now is based on this stuff. We are much like any other hyperscaler or any other content provider. We are thinking in terms of we roll out 10 to 20%. We play with it. We figure out what we're doing. And we look at it and we say, okay, that didn't really work. We need to change a little bit. So we're not completely on this right now. We are slowly moving our way towards it and feeling our way towards it and figuring out exactly how to do some of the things we're trying to get to.
Okay, understood. So what are you using so far then on those boxes?
The one funny thing about LinkedIn is we don't talk about what we're using on our boxes or who we buy from.
Is it Sonic?
No. Good guess. No, not right now. It's not Sonic. What we are currently looking at in the open source world is OpenSwitch. There are some issues that we need to face down and look at with OpenSwitch that we are still considering around what to do. Of course, OpenSwitch just went to the Linux Foundation, and we were pretty excited about that. But, you know, we're bringing more people on board and looking through OpenSwitch and figuring out what needs to be modified and how to make all of this work better at this point. That's kind of where we are.
A question then on the hardware. So if I remember rightly from the blog, that you're looking at the Tomahawk chipset?
That's correct, yes.
So how friendly have you found Broadcom in terms of giving you information? So, you know, if you want to access information that's on the chipset, have they been very kind of, you know, friendly towards your aspirations so far?
By and large, Broadcom has been friendly towards us. I don't know how they deal with other people well enough to make commentary on Broadcom's relationship with the mid-sized market or whatever.
Oh, sure. It was a direct question, I guess, just, you know, solely in the space of your project.
Yeah. For us specifically, Broadcom has been very, very friendly, very forthcoming, very helpful in what they're doing. Of course, they're not going to open their API. We, of course, happen to own a license. So This is one of those things that, for right now, is working well for us. Where that goes in the future, I don't have any ideas about. Again, we're kind of on this leading edge of this in our own network. So there's a lot of open questions about where it goes next and what we do to continue pushing this forward.
Sure. And that leads to the next question in terms of skill sets. So as Elisa kind of asks about, you know, writing an OS or even to the point of writing drivers for the chipsets. I mean, have you got those skill sets internally, or are you kind of harvesting those from somewhere else in the business? I think you must be at a certain point where you have some of those skills already to be able to kind of comprehend some of the tasks that need to be done.
Yeah, so a little of both. We are harvesting as much as we can out of the open source world and using things that are going on, like an open switch with HP and other people who are shoving things into the open switch and into other open source repositories. We are using those where we can. We do happen to have some people on board who have experience, particularly in the hardware realm, with building boxes. We also are building a software team over time. It's going to take us some time to build more of a software team than we have now, but we do have people doing commits already and doing things like just did BFD. They're working around Kafka a little bit, doing some things in those areas. There are some skills already on board. And of course, remember, LinkedIn, right, is its own app.
Yeah.
We do have software processes and stuff already in-house that we can reuse in some way to help us along this path. But we do have other people that we're bringing on board to help us more along these lines.
Okay.
A question here just kind of regarding that entire effort. The blog post indicates that LinkedIn, as of February, has something on the order of 11,500 man hours into this project, which certainly, you know, where I come from, that's a lot more than a science project. That's a pretty big effort. What I'm wondering is, how did you frame that effort in terms of ROI, basically? I mean, the wisdom has always been in most enterprise organizations, right? Don't try to be everything that is not your core business. And that's a big push behind a lot of cloud endeavors right now, right? Is companies looking at trying to get out of running a data center, or running things that they don't need to run that's not core to their business. I guess my question is, does LinkedIn see this infrastructure as such a core part of their business? I mean, has there been any resistance internally to making such a big investment in this project that you're still seeing how it's going to pan out?
As a matter of fact, yes, LinkedIn does typically consider the network to be core to business and to be crucial to the future of the business. And again, this goes back to the concept of, do you allow a vendor to push your business architecture, or do you try to build something around your business architecture? But at the same time, one of the interesting things about LinkedIn, one of the reasons I came to LinkedIn in the first place, in fact, is that LinkedIn's very open and very much concerned about drawing the open source community in and collaborating with others. There's no sense within LinkedIn that we're going to do this on our own, that we're just going to build this and we're going to deploy it and it's all just going to work. That's not the way we look at it. The way we look at it is, we are trying to help build a community around doing this such that other people who are at our scale will have tools and base code and base concepts in place, and will have a better idea of what they're doing to be able to do this type of thing as well. So we're trying to build a little bit of a community around this effort and not do it all on our own. There's a kind of a sense in LinkedIn of doing good for the community, for the networking community, as well as doing what's good for LinkedIn, that we feel like those two things kind of go together. The more that we can help build the community, the better it is for us. This has all been part of that sell. I don't know, and I don't think anybody knows, if we're actually going to save money doing this, but that's not really the point of the whole game. The point of the whole game is get better telemetry, own our architecture, own what we're doing better so that we can build our network the way we need to build it to make our product more competitive or better or something along those lines strategically.
That's an interesting statement there, because, you know, a lot of the arguments that I've heard, or a lot of the driving force behind the white box switching historically, has been this is a lower capital expenditure to get into that market. But what a lot of folks don't think about is that your operational expenditure, at least at the beginning, is going to go way up, right? Because you're going to have to do things like develop processes and code and things like that around this white box stuff. But you guys have thought through all of those things and decided that the goal is not to save money, it's to get better telemetry.
Get better telemetry and to own our architecture. We started with better telemetry. In the end, what we're going to end up with is what we want is we want to own our own architecture as well. There's been like this creeping, we're doing more and more with this, thinking about this more and more. And one of the things we're coming to now is that we just really need to or want to get to the point where we're not vendor controlled or pushed in the way that we build our network in any way, shape, or form.
So have you guys thought at all about, and is it a concern from the point of view of operating the network, that now that you own your own architecture, it's a snowflake? You can't take a random networking guy off the street that's been doing Cisco stuff for 10 years or whatever, throw him in there, and he'll just understand everything that's going on because it's a completely unique ecosystem at that point. Has that ever come up as a possible concern, or have you guys addressed that in any way?
So there's two things there. First of all, of course, again, like I said, we're trying to build a community and do it as much as we can in a community effort so that there are other people doing the same sorts of things. Second of all, I think we're structuring it in such a way that, yes, the network operating system piece of it is probably going to be a pretty unique snowflake, but it's going to be an open source available snowflake, but it's going to be no more unique than someone who only knows how to use iOS or someone who only knows GNOS or only knows Arista or whatever the case might be. I mean, that's just the reality of dealing with network operating systems and CLIs and things like that. From a control plane and other perspectives, it's going to be a little bit different because, again, we're focusing on Yang models and other modeling systems, and we're focusing on Kafka, which not a lot of people know at this point. I mean, a lot of data people do, but not a lot of networking people do. But at the same time, I'm not sure that that's a huge barrier to entry as far as getting up to speed on what we're going to build and what we're doing. I think when we're done with it, it'll be rational enough and it'll be well enough thought out.
Yeah,
that I mean, any average network engineer should be able to walk in and go, oh, look, yeah, I see what they did there.
Yeah, I mean, I was mostly baiting you with that. That was kind of a trick question.
Because no, that's fine.
Every network of that size is, in fact, a snowflake, and there's always an amount of reverse engineering that's got to happen to really understand what's going on.
Yeah, but see, this drives me back to my whole shtick about Rule 11, right? And about how network engineers need to learn theory and understand how things work, rather than just learning the CLI. In fact, I can be radical and say you shouldn't learn the CLI anymore, but let's not go there because that's not true yet. I think there will come a day when we won't have that issue. People won't be so focused on the CLI. Just that if you understand routing and you understand policy, the final intent is that you'll only be able to walk into our network and understand what we've done. If you just understand the Cisco CLI, you may struggle understanding our network. But of course, that's going to have to be taken into consideration when we interview people and when we do, you know, stuff like that.
I would agree on that.
That's something that I think is true, but not often said, is that you need to know the concepts, right? If you don't have the concepts, you don't have the foundation. If you don't have the foundation, you're not going to understand anything except for what the vendor has fed you.
Yeah, I was just about to raise this kind of philosophical question on that. Just because, you know, the Cisco CLI doesn't make you a, you know, knowledgeable networking person, it makes you a, and I don't want to do this and get a flame for it, but it makes you a jockey. I mean, if you're running BGP and you're moving IP packets, then it's a network at the end of the day.
Right. Yep. Exactly.
I think the only counterpoint to that is just, you know, when you do spend a lot of time with one specific product line, for instance, you know, you get to learn the ins and outs of it. And it is about more than just the CLI. It's understanding how those products and various vendors' implementations of those products interact with one another. Certainly for all of my career, and I think for everyone on this call, you know, we've always kind of been told, well, these are transferable skills, right? Sure, I understand networking in the broad sense, but my expertise is with Cisco products. And it's always been understood that I can go almost anywhere and use those skills with not a lot of immediate transition required. And I think what's interesting here is just if you look toward, you know, you look out a little bit, maybe what we get to is, you know, of course, Facebook runs Facebook brand switches and Google runs Google brand switches and LinkedIn runs LinkedIn brand switches. And I don't know if Amazon runs Amazon brand switches yet, but they probably will.
Of course they do.
It certainly, I think, brings more focus onto that need to be willing to change at a moment's notice and embrace everything that you're uncomfortable with.
Right. And in reality, if you think about it, this is part of what the white box movement is about, right? Part of the white box movement is, you know, I said at the very beginning when we were chatting before the actual starting shooting off the starting gun by Yvonne there. You know, I own Macs and I own PCs. One of the things I actually like about PCs, and I'm probably going to get flames about this, is that I can go to Dell or I can go to Lenovo or I can go to HP or I can go to wherever, and I buy hardware. And yeah, there are vagaries of each one. There are some things that some do that others don't do. And there are particular video cards that one use and video chipsets and this, that, and the other. But in the long run, a PC is a PC is a PC. 80 to 90% of that functionality remains constant across. And I think that's actually one of the goals of the entire white box movement, is trying to get to that. Whether or not the market will accept that and do that is a question of its own. But I think that's what people are trying to do.
But what I see in what some of the companies like LinkedIn are doing here, just to extend that metaphor a bit, is it's more than just the last company I was at, we use Dell with Windows on it, and this company, we use HP. But instead, everybody's running their own operating system, which has a couple impacts, right? One is new employees got certainly some ramping up to do in terms of understanding how that system works. And there's a lot more of a learning curve there. And again, in a larger environment, you know, a web scale environment, I think there's an expectation that new employees have a lot of learning to do. Whereas in most of the mid-size market, the expectation is that somebody comes in knowing pretty much everything they need to do their job. But I think the other interesting impact there is it means that certainly each of those companies that's chosen to go that direction in terms of writing their own NOS, for instance, now has to keep up with everything happening in the industry. I mean, what if the next shiny new protocol comes out from the IETF after 99 years in committee and everybody's starting to use this because it's some great use case, right? It's now pinned on you to now implement that potentially in your environment. And I think it's just interesting that it adds a whole new set of, I don't want to call them burdens, but a whole new set of challenges that have to be accommodated just in terms of keeping up with that product that you've now decided to build for yourself rather than buying off the shelf.
Right.
I think this is an interesting point we want to make comment on. Do you think that problem really genuinely exists? Because if you reduce the footprint of the white box movement, you think, well, actually, let's look at this. We want to own the architecture. We want to do very specific things. We want to normalize across all of the environment so we can manage it easier and get the information we want out. Just because the IETF eventually comes out and releases some new spec, which may or may not solve the business problems, do you necessarily have to go off and implement it? You know, I think if you're running a very normalized environment and doing very specific things, A, there's less to learn than finding a new kind of Cisco box or a vendor-driven box, whatever. There aren't 35,000 features. You've got the business features that you require to do the job. I don't know if this is a real problem or not. I think all of us are at the age on this call where we've gone through the hard knocks of life learning stuff. And, you know, behind me now on my bookshelf, there's probably hundreds of kind of various Cisco Press books and O'Reilly books and whatever. But one of the freeing things about where this thing is going is we're being much more focused on what needs to be done, instead of having to learn lots of things and then feel daunted when something new comes along. So I think in reality, it's much simpler than a lot of the stuff we've already previously learned.
Yeah, and I think that's part of the point, is that part of the white box movement also has to be to separate better between what the control plane does and what the box is doing, right? And to start thinking more in terms of that BGP thing is basically like a web browser or something like that that runs on top. It has certain interfaces into the box that it has to use and do, but I can kind of treat them as separate things. And I can kind of learn about BGP and understand what questions I need to ask of BGP before I go into the job. And I don't necessarily have to learn everything about that operating system to get what I need to get done. At least I kind of hope that. I don't know if that's true or not. I mean, there's always going to be some leaky abstraction problem, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, you're going to run into edge cases with pretty much anything. To me, just kind of take a step back, and I realize we're kind of dwelling on the motivations and stuff here, but to me, it seems like, one, this is going to force a couple of things. The white box movement in general is going to force some things that I think are important anyway, right? So it's going to force internal documentation and external documentation, right? If it's an open source operating system or an open source project, it should have good docs. If it doesn't have good docs, then it's essentially a non-starter for most people. Two, the internal folks, when you're hiring new people, this to me functionally forces good hiring practices, in my opinion, right? Because I don't want to hire someone based on a skill set. If they have the skill set, great. What I want to hire someone for is attitude and aptitude, right? If they have the aptitude to come in, read the docs, they have the fundamentals, and they understand being able to understand what's going on, that's going to be so much more valuable than just hiring what has been described as a jockey. So there are very far-reaching implications for this movement that are way beyond technology, but we've kind of spent quite a bit of time on the motivation
No, that's okay, because I think that that is an important thing, and I think that one of the interesting things about LinkedIn from my perspective as a network engineer is I think LinkedIn gets that we need to move away from being focused on specific whatever it is, and somehow or another, we need to get the community together to do the right thing for the mid-scale and even for the large-scale and stuff. Somewhere, somebody's got to do something about getting the basic infrastructure in place. It's got to start with somebody, and LinkedIn's trying to be part of that, let's start this kind of thing.
That's cool. I mean, I think those are all very valiant efforts, and I really hope that they trickle out. And I think that they will, you know, as this becomes more and more of a thing, regardless of how far you guys take it, it's out there, it's open source, so it will eventually trickle up and trickle down.
I think the lovely thing about this as well, if you look at this from a distance, there's a lot of organizations right now are trying to enforce, say, kind of better working practices between the networking team, the applications team, and instead of having new product which does all these things which you can integrate against, what you've just done is you've removed the silo completely and you've changed where the network is, forcing new relationships to be formed and forcing networking people now to integrate more closely. So I think by changing your perspective, you've changed the problem. And I know this is a whole white box thing again, but this is a really healthy viewpoint.
Yeah, I agree. So to kind of come back around to the more technical side, what did you guys use as the baseline for what you were trying to accomplish when you started thinking about the white box?
Oh boy, this is a tough question because it's all over the place. Different people on the team have different goals, which I think is natural and healthy in an architecture team of this type. You know, we have 6-8 people sitting around thinking about what they want to get done, and we're all trying to come to a final conclusion about what the final answer is. And I'm not sure we're there today, and I'm not sure we'll ever will be because, you know, it's the old, 16 network architects to design your network, you're going to have one writing and 15 erasing on the whiteboard. So that's kind of the way it is. What we basically used as our initial baseline was the two things of better telemetry and owning our own architecture. How we get there is being shaped as we go through this process. So those were kind of our initial baseline. As far as like, are you asking like scale and stuff like that? Scale baselines are basically around our fabric size and what we think our current and future requirements are for routing information and how fast that has to change and things like that. And then the baseline again around Kafka and the way it's already integrated into the LinkedIn environment, that kind of falls into the baseline type stuff. And then being able to work with multiple different things at the same time is, this is something we're looking at, like I said, like Yang models, PSEP, things like that, that we need to look at for southbound interfaces and understand those better. There are other things that play into it. We use Anycast for load sharing on almost everything now. And so Anycast plays into the entire architecture. How well does it work? How do you get ECMP to work and things like that? How does that work with the Anycast bits of the LinkedIn app as it sits today? And then there are future things going on. I mean, there's future requirements that may or may not be coming down the road that we're looking at around more real-time traffic and stuff like that, that are actually playing into the whole requirements process.
So what on the telemetry side have you guys been able to improve for yourselves so far? You said the Kafka thing is still in progress, but are you getting any additional data out of the devices that you've been able to see so far?
Yeah, I mean, we're actually able to see a lot more about queue state, jitter, delay, things like that. We're starting to get to the point where we're building the tools around or thinking about how to do hotspots in the fabric and how that plays back into the control plane and shaping things like that. There's already work in that area and there are some results, but primarily right now it's at the chipset level. You know, we'll eventually bring that up into a higher level view of more fabric-based stuff.
And just to add to that, so that's what you're collecting and that's what you're trying to have visibility into. How are you extracting that? So all that is going through Kafka, right? And then you're taking it from Kafka and doing something with it?
Well, right now it's not going through Kafka. Right now it's just simply being collected into a central server and we're looking at it through a series of interfaces. Right now, the Kafka work is ongoing with actually implementing that in the Kafka.
So yeah, sorry, just to kind of recap then, how is it kind of being extracted away from the networking hardware and put onto the server? Or is it being pushed? Is it being pulled? Is it, you know, have you just kind of thrown it through SNMP at the moment, or are you doing it through some other method?
No, we're not throwing it through SNMP. We have an ongoing bad relationship with SNMP at LinkedIn.
It's all syslog. Right?
Yeah, so does everyone.
I don't like fighting.
Okay. But if we step back to the hardware, so if I understood you correctly, you started with an existing commercial product and you added functionality to it, right?
We aren't wrapping our own sheet metal. We're buying from vendors. We're not wrapping our own sheet metal.
Yeah, and I would suspect that you decided to use something that has Linux running on it just to make your life easier, right?
Yes, correct.
So there are like two usual suspects, and I won't even name them. And then because you wanted to use the cheap level access, you licensed the Broadcom API, if I understood correctly.
Yes, we currently have a Broadcom API license. That's correct.
And that is probably running in parallel with the commercial operating system running on that same box, and it allows you to extract data straight from the chip registers.
Correct. Exactly. That's where we are right now.
And then you pack that data into JSON or whatever, and you ship it to the server, and you analyze it on the server.
Yeah, that's pretty much what's going on right now. Correct.
Okay.
Some of the things that we're looking at right now is, you know, do we necessarily need a Broadcom license? Or do we not? I mean, is there a way we can not do it? We don't really know the answer to that right now. Right now we have one. Again, we're trying to think about the bigger, larger community and how does the larger community work with this. So there are questions around that entire piece of it right now that haven't been answered. We don't know the answer to those things. There are questions in our minds and questions that we bring up in team meetings that we haven't resolved at this point.
I was looking at the public Broadcom API because now they actually have something that is documented on the outside.
Are you looking at SAI itself or are you just looking at
OpenNSL or something?
OpenNSL is Open Network Linux. Or are you thinking, well, Broadcom is working, and several other vendors, by the way, are also working around the SAI interface, which is an open interface. That's actually what we're trying to use as much as we can. Again, that's kind of a nascent effort. They're not everything is in there that we necessarily need right now. It's being worked on even as we speak, and people are adding things to it. Over time, this goes back to the Broadcom license question. Will it be possible to get what we want without the Broadcom license in a year or two? We actually don't know the answer to that right now. It just depends.
Go ahead.
I want to sneak in the YAN question. So are there any existing YAN models for chipset data, or at least the open part so far? Or did you have to write those? Or is that not YAN related at this time?
That's not YAN related at this time. We're primarily looking at YAN models as a southbound interface and as a control plane level type of thing right now. The chipset level stuff is probably just going to be always packaged in JSON and shoved through Kafka or whatever mechanism to get it out. Because if you buy more than one chipset eventually, which is a consideration for us, then you know you end up in this position where you've got to build your tools with its own abstraction layer into it to be able to manage multiple chipsets in the right way or to extract the right data in the right way.
Right, but then the YAN model on top of it would be something, I don't know, the same way we're doing YAN models for BGP, whatever, on top of all kinds of different vendors right now, something that would abstract that general key value store information, whatever.
We're just not discussing that yet. We haven't gotten to that point yet. We're too early. We're too early to think about that quite yet.
I feel like I keep asking the questions that bring roadblocks somewhere.
No, that's fine. That's fine. You know, a lot of people have the impression that we're further along in this than we are. I shouldn't say we're not far along. It's just that the impression is that we're running our entire data center on this, blah, blah, blah. In reality, this is something we're currently working on. There's current work going on in this space. We are still making decisions. We're still building things and deciding what the future looks like in some areas. And part of it too is as well, we have these ideas, but then we hit this particular roadblock and we have to rethink it, right? There are always times when you're thinking through and you think, I'm going that direction. And then you realize, you know what? That's really not necessarily going to work. We probably need to go this direction instead.
Do you have an example of something? Like what was a problem that you got into?
Like the five last roadblocks that you could name.
that I could name. I like the way you put that. There's not anything that I can really point to specifically other than saying the same thing I said before about, for instance, the Broadcom API stuff, right? Broadcom versus SAI and open interfaces. We don't honestly know if any of the open interfaces that are going to be available are going to meet our requirements or not. So are we going to keep a Broadcom license or not? I don't know the answer to that right now. We have it right now, but will it remain there? We don't really know. It just depends on how the future goes. Open source is the same way. You know, you think you're going to get this and that and the other done, and then the open source community kind of turns a slightly different direction. You have to rethink kind of what you're doing, not in terms of going open source, but in terms of how you go about doing that, or, you know what I'm saying, like what pieces you use to do different things. That's just normal, I think, software development process stuff that you get into. You think you can build something a certain way, and you get into it and you realize, really, a quick sort's not right there. Really, you need to do an insertion sort or something like that. So that's kind of the situation we're in some cases, where we're still kind of thinking things through about how to do certain things.
Going back to Lisa's point, I quite like you saying certain things are not done very well. I mean, if you look at NetConf and Yang, I mean, I don't particularly have great experience with NetConf when it comes to operational data. So trying to get, you know, system state, and if you're dealing with that via a different method, so shoving it into JSON and Kafka or whatever, that seems like a really nice kind of way you've solved that problem. And then maybe, you know, you do end up going with, you know, Yang and NetConf to do some configuration. Maybe, I don't know. It sounds really exciting the way that you're not just going, right, we're going to use OpenConfig for this, and that's it. You know, it sounds like you're just letting the thing kind of organically move along.
Yep, that's exactly right. And that's part of the problem, is that we're kind of like, okay, we might use this. We think about using that. But when we get into it and we start thinking about it, the operations guys say, no, not so much. We don't want that, right? It's like NetConf itself is actually a transport. It's not really a modeling tool, right? So right. We're probably not going to be using NetConf. We're probably going to be transporting Yang-ish stuff, OpenConf, and other things in Kafka instead. So that's kind of a decision we've made. Will it turn out in the long term that we mean to change that? I don't know right now. I hope not, because I think it's a good direction, but who knows, right? It's kind of more, let's see what happens when it gets there.
That sounds interesting. I've got one question, a really important question. How come you went with the name Pigeon? So for anybody from the UK listening to this, you know, pigeons are fat birds that are just dumb and fall over and get run over.
You know, it's a good question, and I don't know the answer to it.
Okay, we'll come back.
who came up with that, right?
Well, they're the same thing in the U.S. I don't know. There's some particular reason, and I'm not sure what it is.
Oh, you know, it's because of that heroic South African pigeon that transported data faster than DSL from the service provider.
There you go. There you go.
Only
fine.
Two or three to make it back. They've got an RFC. One of the pigeons didn't make it, I'm sure, you know.
So one more question about your experience so far. So you said you set this up in like a POP or on a device somewhere. You got additional chipset data out of it. And did it help you? What did you guys do?
Right now, what we're doing with that data is we're starting to figure out, it's more of analysis phase right now, because this is so newish to us, that right now what we're doing is we're just looking at it and trying to say, okay, that's interesting. Where does this go? What do we do with this? How do we operationalize this data? Because of course, at LinkedIn, like most other companies, we have an ops side, we have an architecture side, right? And the ops guys are basically the architecture guys draw things on whiteboards, take pictures of it and hand it to the ops guys, and the ops guys figure out how to do it. No, not really.
That sounds familiar.
Yeah, right, exactly. I mean, actually, our architecture team tends to be very hands-on compared to a lot of architecture teams. We tend to be a lot more in the data center doing stuff and things like that. The architecture team at LinkedIn actually comes out of the ops side by and large. So there's a great deal of synergy going on there and a lot of co-working and stuff like that. So, and as an example, by the way we run projects internally is kind of interesting. We actually have essentially a small IETF within LinkedIn.
That sounds terrible. Oh my God. I'm so sorry for you.
The listeners who have just crashed the cars were very sorry. We didn't mean to cause that reaction. And yeah,
and
please don't claim three insurance.
In the background.
Yeah, it was.
So it was like, to whom the bell tolls.
It's 6:30. That's me.
Well, this was just on time. He said IETF and the bell went like bam.
That's brilliant.
So seriously, though, I mean, what we do is we solicit input from the operation side when we're doing the design and architecture work.
Oh, so you're not like IETF.
Don't even get me started on IETF and operators. I'm so desperate for more people to get involved in the IETF and the operational side. But that's another entire topic. Anyway, yeah, we try to be much more collaborative and bottom up. And we allow people, when they see a problem, to look at it and say, oh, this is a problem. Let me input this into this entire process. And there are working groups with co-chairs, and those working groups can take that work on and put it as a work item and think through whether or not it needs to be done, come up with a design. And those working groups are not just made up of architecture people. They're made up of ops and development, all sorts of people, storage people, tons of people are on those working groups from all over the place. So we try to get as wide of a group within LinkedIn to work on something as possible. So that way we don't end up with this kind of feeling of architecture tossing things across the cubicle wall to the ops guys, and the ops guys going, oh, this is cute. I don't know what to do with this little thing. Don't even know why you would want to do this. You know, we try to make it a lot more bottom-up sort of environment. So that's another reason why when you ask me things about where are you going to this, well, there's no top-down process. It's kind of depends on what ideas the community comes up with within LinkedIn and how those ideas play out. I know the ideas I'm working on, I know what I'm doing, but there are other people who are working on different things that are perhaps even smarter than what I'm doing. Well, probably are, because anyway, I'm just an old fart network engineer, you know.
Ain't we all?
So from an engineering point of view, the little kind of, you know, the network engineer jumping up and down inside is doing a root cause analysis on your journey. One of the things which kind of piqued some curiosity was the problem itself, where he says the problem was quite subtle, and you'd see that there would be flash floods of packets that would occasionally overwhelm the switching chips. And that's a reference from the article, I think, that we've all read. Is that because of the way your architecture is with the Anycast, or is that completely unrelated?
My impression is it's completely unrelated. The Anycast works really well. I think what we're seeing is we're seeing ECMP. Everyone knows that ECMP works perfect in every chipset, right?
It works as designed.
Full of features.
Yes, right, exactly. I think what we're seeing more is ECMP things and just things of that nature, more than we're seeing application issues or seeing Anycast problems. Now, of course, we're hoping to find places where maybe Anycast doesn't work perfectly so we can fine-tune how we're doing it a little bit. And we're hoping to find problems in the application because, hey, after all, if you're not making the application better, then what are you doing for a living, right? But right now, I think what we're mostly running into is elephant flows that we didn't actually anticipate or expect on the fabric, and ECMP things that we didn't expect. That's mostly, I think, what we're running into at the moment. I don't know if we're fine-grained enough to see the other things at this point, or if we've deployed it widely enough to see those other things at this point.
That's great feedback. Thanks for sharing.
So those are actually things that you learned from getting out of Pigeon.
Yes. We took the pigeon and we unrolled the little piece of paper on the bottom of it, and
there it dropped.
there it dropped. There it was. And then a big eagle swooped down and never mind.
And there you go. There's version 2 of the product right there.
Yeah, that'll be the chassis switch.
So, that's an interesting discussion. We don't do chassis switches, so that's another entire interesting discussion.
Russ, from the operational perspective, if I understood correctly what you're doing, it's more or less read-only access to the switches, right?
At this point, yes.
So right now, the risk of deploying this is pretty minimal.
Well, I mean, so long as you don't mind crashing your data center if you made a mistake someplace, sure.
Yeah, of course.
Sorry.
Yeah, but you are running this on commercial gear, and you are probably collecting data through a user mode process, so.
Correct. That's correct.
Can you really crash the box with that?
Yvonne,
that sounds like a challenge right there.
In theory, you cannot. In practice, however.
Come on.
Yeah, we all know that's not the case.
That was not a bug. That was an unintended feature, right?
Right.
We know all about those.
So I always enjoy the show commands that cause the reboots.
It was just overwhelmed to comply with you. That's all.
That I will accept.
So to oversimplify, you were seeing some latency on some switch ports, and so your solution to that was to build your own line of switches, which is an engineer's solution if I've ever heard one. But has there ever been a point where you kind of thought, oh, we've bitten off more than we can chew here, kind of in that process of going, you know, oh, well, we're just going to implement X. And then, oh, well, actually, in order to implement X, we've got to do this and this because X doesn't work the way we thought we did. I mean, has this been kind of what your sort of standard software development process, or has this been like, we're so far in now, we've got to keep digging?
Every single day.
Okay.
Every single meeting. Yes. Have we really bitten off more than we can chew? But again, remember that this isn't just about the telemetry. This is about the telemetry. This isn't just about the telemetry, though, right? There's more to this in the commitment that we want to own our own architecture, right? This is like, to our upper level management, if you're a company that provides a social media service like this, you need to own your own architecture. You just do. You just have to do this. Then that kind of, again, falls into how can we do this and try to make it where it's not more than I can chew. You work with the community as much as you can. And that's good for the community. It's good for you. You hope it all works. Who knows? Maybe the community comes crashing down and burning, but not as long as we can help it, right? We're doing what we can to work with other people at our scale. And by the way, the people we're working with, they're all under NDA right now because we're early enough that we just don't want stuff coming out that, whatever, it's kind of weird, but that's kind of where we are right now.
Okay, Russ, if someone wants to join this effort, then how would he approach you, or who should he approach to get into this effort?
Well, I'm pretty easy to find. You can just email me.
Okay, so are you the right guy to approach?
I can get you in touch with the right people and get you involved in some areas, and other areas you'd need to get in touch with other people. But yeah, in general, if you contact me, I'm a good gateway to get people involved if mid-scales want to get involved in this. That and Open19, which you may not have seen, that's another LinkedIn thing that we're gathering up people. There should be a webpage up now around Open19. Any of those efforts, if you want anything to know anything about what we're doing or want to get involved in some way, send me an email.
Thank you. And by the way, now that you said mid-size, how would you define that? How big, how small should I be for this to make sense to me?
Oh my goodness. That's a hard question, Yvonne. You know that's a hard, that's like enterprise. I hate that mid-size term too. But anyway, enterprise term. But like I said, our scale is, you know, 3-4 data centers, something along those lines, 70 to 100K servers. I would say that the work we're doing would be of interest to people down into the, I'm just going to throw rough guesses out, 20, 30K server range, 40K server range, physical hardware boxes. As things move along and the effort becomes more solidified and better developed, I think it will move downscale. But for right now, you probably have to be large enough to provide some commit resources and things like that to help out for it to be really interesting and useful to you at this point.
So around 50,000 switch ports.
Well, yeah, that's my guess. And again, that's just total throwing numbers out. I have no idea. I guess it would depend as much on your business model and what you're doing in your network and what your goals are and what you're willing to invest in time and effort to do it.
Thank you.
I've got one more question, and this is actually a personal question to you. Is you're kind of, by reputation, you're sort of Mr. Cisco, right? You're one of the early CCIEs. You were instrumental in the development of the CCDE program. You're one of the handful of people holding the that most exalted on high Cisco certified architect certification. From your standpoint, how did you sort of internalize this transition to rolling your own solutions? I mean, was that something that was kind of difficult for you to swallow? Did you ever have that sort of get off my lawn moment? Or, I mean, I think I know the answer to this already just from our discussion so far, but I mean, you know, how's that been for you moving into this this new world that is so un-vendor focused?
So in reality, it's kind of strange because I started making that transition even when I worked for Cisco. And I think it was partially because of where I was in Cisco. I was played this unique role between technical services and engineering, kind of in the middle. And from early on days, I think several of us realized that the technology is more important than the feature set per se. That kind of drove a lot of what has happened since then in terms of what I've written and what I've done and stuff like that. Moving to VeriSign out of Cisco was probably the first point where I realized that the world was bigger than a single vendor. And then when I went to Ericsson, I think Cisco's changing slowly but surely in this regard, but Ericsson had a much more open attitude. And I think going to LinkedIn was not as big of a transition for me as going from Cisco to VeriSign was in the first place, working in VeriSign Labs. Even before that, again, you know, for me, it's always been more of a technology thing than it is a vendor thing. So I have nothing against Cisco. I really like Cisco gear, and I have a good relationship with tons of people there. I just think the networking world is bigger than just Cisco is, and I think that network engineers need to realize that and move beyond it. In fact, if you look at the CCDE and the CCAR, they are intentionally supposed to be vendor independent, specifically because the team that worked on them said, we need to show that this industry is bigger than just Cisco. That was, I think, part of the point of doing those certifications in the first place. So that's kind of another perhaps answer. So my road to this point has been long. I've had a long time to adjust to the concepts involved rather than being thrown to the wolves in one step. So I think it's been easier for me than maybe for other people.
It's good feedback. Thanks.
So thank you, Russ, for this really interesting chat. If people want to know more, where can they find you? You said they can just email you, but, well, I could probably just type Russ White into the Google and...
Yeah, you'll find me there someplace. My email address is on my LinkedIn profile. You can reach me through my blog if you feel like it, which is rule11.us. The name of the blog is Network. I also blog various other places. You can go to any IETF mailing list. I'm now co-chair of two working groups in the IETF, so I have yet another place you can find me is just go to the IETF and look up the working groups I'm co-chair of. You can find my email address there and et cetera. So I'm easy to find.
Perfect. Thank you. And you'll be on my online course in September, right?
Yep.
So I hope we'll be able to explore more of the white box switching phenomenon there.
Of course.
And now for my co-host, yet again in sort of alphabetical order, which would mean starting with Bob, right? Where can people find you, Bob?
I guess I should point out for this particular show, you can find me on LinkedIn. search for me there. Of course, I'm on the Twitter at Bob McCouch, and I believe that my blog still exists, although it is sorely derelict, and that's at herdingpackets.net.
Oh, but previously you really wanted to say Microsoft B2B social media, right? Next one, David G.
Hey, so you can also find me on the Microsoft recruitment software on LinkedIn, on the blog at rpengineer.net, and on the Twitters at vtep42.
Elisa?
Still no blog, still no Twitter, but I'm also on LinkedIn.
Why no blog, Elisa? What's the problem?
I just don't like the writing thing.
She has life and work.
Huh.
I don't know anything about that.
Mm.
And finally, Nick.
Oh, you can find me, of course, on LinkedIn at it's Baralio, and then on Twitter, it's Baralio, and then on my website is forwardingplane.net, although I also own Baralio.com and NetNorg, but I don't really write on those much.
Thank you, everyone. And I'm Ivan Pepelnik. You can find me at ibspace.net, also on LinkedIn, of course. And if you want to listen to other episodes of this podcast, just go to sdn.ipspace.net, where you'll find the links to SDN-related blog posts, podcast episodes, presentations, webinars, videos, you name it. And keep in mind, we call this software-defined, but as you've heard today from Russ, it's actually running on ASICs.